You're ready? Maybe we can jump in with a quick personal introduction, your backgrounds, how long you've been with the RRA, just so we know who we're talking to.
Okay. Well, my name is Richard Savi. I'm the current Commissioner General for Rwanda Revenue Authority, a role that I've been in now for 4 years. Prior to that, I was Deputy Commissioner General and Commissioner for Customs, a job that I did for 3 years. But before that, I was working in private sector.
Okay.
I'm an accountant by profession. So in private sector, I was serving as Chief Financial Officer of one of the telecom companies in Rwanda.
Okay. Yeah. So our case study is backward looking. So we're going to tell the story sort of 10, 15 years, which is obviously a big job getting everything in there. And we won't cover everything. But I would like to ask you, you know, you have significant time that you've spent here. If you look back maybe 7 years, 8 years, and even longer than that, given what you've learned from people previously, how would you characterize the challenges that faced the RRA, let's say in the mid-2000s, as it was trying to sort of build up its ability to improve tax collection? Maybe two or three of the big things that stood out.
Well, I think three big things that were affecting Revenue Authority back then were, again, a mirror of what happened in this country with the genocide against the Tutsi in 1994. Basically, the economy was shattered, non-existing, moving towards the failed state, so the economy was not there. But more importantly, the people. So the elite, if you look at the genocide again, people were killed, others left the country. So they tried to build a tax administration on a shaky and weak economy in terms of private sector. People are already doing business.
Yeah.
And they are trying to attract investors all over the globe to come and invest here with the genocide history still in people's mind.
Yeah.
And with a weak skill base. So for you to strike that balance, I think it was extremely difficult to attract investors.
Yeah.
And even give comfort to those, the few who are still there here, that this is the place to be.
Yeah.
But getting people to support the tax administration, because the Revenue Authority was established, I think, in 1998.
Yeah.
So it's quite young in terms of age as an institution.
Yeah.
So the question was, we need to move into a more stable economy.
Yes.
But how do you get people to come? Where are you going to get the resources? It takes decades to develop skill base, develop people who can come and serve. But the demand is now, then.
Yeah.
So under the leadership of our president, I think we made a very strong choice to say, let us try to get people who are skilled to come and help us.
Right.
And one of the moves that was done, I think back in when we joined the East African Community, that was a big milestone.
Right.
Because we're saying, as we become a member of the East African Community, allow free movement of people, labor start coming in. So you're getting Kenyans, you're getting Tanzanians, you're getting, bringing capital, but not only capital, bring the people as well to line the capital and support the economy to grow.
Yeah.
But also try to leverage on people who have a little bit advanced.
Yeah.
Specifically, I think that time Ghana was a little bit advanced, and we got one of the former, the first commissioner general here was a Ghanaian.
I find it to be extraordinary to imagine that. to me, it demonstrates a kind of sincerity about wanting to fix the situation, that you're willing to open up such an important national institution to someone from another country. I think it's quite amazing.
but that's the journey that we've had, and when you bring in this new commissioner general, now you need to start having reforms in place. So for you to have reforms, you need to understand even what you're reforming and how you're going to support the reforms.
Right.
So again, you need a support system in terms of partners who are going to understand you.
Yeah.
And back then, up to today, we had DFID.
Right.
Who understood the vision of the country, the leadership, and they supported us. And back then again, we had an expert in charge of reform and modernization.
Mm-hmm.
So to drive the reform agenda, you need someone who has been there.
From Defit.
From Defit.
Yeah. Do you know? Do you remember the name of that person?
Yes, someone by the name of Kieran Holmes.
Okay, there we go.
So that brought in confidence. As the government was trying to stabilize the economy, trying to attract investors, the tax administration was shaping up in terms of getting skills, trying to benchmark, and ensure that the skills that we are getting are actually going to serve the taxpayers in a sustainable manner.
Yeah.
Again, with the support of the deployment partners, we had people going like for master's degrees to study in tax administration.
Right, overseas.
So, overseas.
Yeah.
So we managed to build that kind of skill base, leveraging on other people's skills and accepting our gaps.
Yeah.
And also having partners who understand that actually this is a marathon. You're going to run for many, many years. It's not a sprint where you run for 5 years and you stop.
Yeah.
And we're lucky that they are still supporting us in that direction.
Right.
Yeah.
So the capacity question is sort of central to starting the story. I mean, almost nothing could have happened subsequently if you didn't manage to relatively quickly build up that kind of capacity. So I've read that sort of the previous tax office was within the finance ministry, and I think they had 200 staff members at that time. Now, I don't know how close you were to this process back then, but how did you just sort of get the basics right in the beginning? Because I've read about things like, you know, people had to reapply when joining the RRA and competency tests and stuff like this. Can you give me a sense of how you sort of put in place the bare bones back then necessary to do everything else?
Yeah, I think the bare bones back then was to say, okay, we need to build a strong tax administration. And there are people who had done it, like I mentioned, other countries who were a little bit advanced. So one of the key reforms that was happening at that time was trying to consolidate the customs and tax so that you have a holistic view of a taxpayer.
Yes.
So we moved into that direction, but that was not, again, not enough. You can move these two.
Yeah.
But again, the leadership realized that we need to have a kind of level of flexibility.
Mm.
So we're given the same autonomous capability to run the institution, where you have capacity to hire and fire as need arises and under the leadership of a board. So you're not many in the mainstream of the public service that might be having a little bit of more bureaucratic tape kind of procedure and procedures.
So you have more flexibility.
We have more flexibility to really engage, hire the good skills.
Yeah.
People are not really behaving in terms of tax administration is really, you cannot move away from corruption. Yeah. You're talking of money. So how do you instill discipline?
Yeah.
So you need that kind of flexibility to say, we are seeing this kind of behavior, even if you don't have to get someone ready-handed with money.
Yeah.
But if there's the code of conduct that we have speaks to our kind of business.
Right.
Unlike the mainstream of public service that might tell you need to get one the person 3 times, the first time you fire, you need to get this evidence.
Yeah.
So that gives us flexibility. So that also helped in terms of how do you set up an institution, what capabilities do they have, how is decision making made, and how are you flexible to resource
the
skill base.
And higher salaries is the other thing that I also read about, since it has this status.
Yes, when you got that semi autonomous authority, we are also flexible in terms of rewarding. So remuneration was also strong, so we managed to be an employee of choice as we are trying to build the education system. We had the privilege of attracting the best talent that was coming out at that time.
Yeah.
So that's how we managed to really move a little bit faster in that direction of building a strong tax administration.
Right.
But Again, another thing maybe that I'll speak about is to begin to understand the society that we are serving. Mm. We are talking about, as you try to build a strong private sector, you are dealing with people who are, most of them are illiterate.
Mm.
So you need to design tax policies that speak to their language.
Yeah.
So one of the things that we have done was to design again the tax regimes that are conducive to the small players.
Mm-hmm.
And that has been done. If you look at our tax regime, you can make a declaration and pay on a, what we call a presumptive or a flat amount. Oh. Without you hiring an accountant to come and cost you more money.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, to fulfill your obligations. Then came the drive to say, okay, how do you, if you are going to put people, get people out of the informal sector, one of the things that you're going to do is to reduce the cost of being formal.
Yes.
And one of the costs of being formal is the compliance cost.
Yeah.
So how do you reduce the compliance cost? You need to get into making it easy for people to declare and pay taxes without making, spending days and days.
Yes.
Today being 28th March, our filing date is 31st March.
Right.
The deadline.
I've seen a lot of people downstairs.
We used to have a tent put,
yeah,
because people were sleeping here.
Oh, yeah.
Waiting to be served.
So compared to then, it's actually nothing now.
So most of them are declaring, yeah, in their office or at home and paying without coming here.
Yeah.
So those are the reforms that we've been trying to put in place. But all that is again aligned in by saying, which league do you want to play in as a,
yeah,
country? I think we would say to play in the first world league.
Yeah.
And how do we do that? Is to benchmark ourselves with the best practices. And Rwanda has embraced the World Bank Doing Business Indicators,
mm-hmm,
report. It's an annual report. I hope you've seen it.
Yeah.
And that report looks at how do you create a conducive business environment.
Yeah.
And they've gone as far as having a specific indicator on paying taxes.
Yeah.
So they look at time, how long do the taxpayers spend in the paying,
yeah,
of complying with paying taxes. They look at the tax rates,
yeah,
how the tax rates are, they really too high.
Yeah. How many visits to the offices?
How many visits?
Yeah.
How can you, instead of paying maybe every month, can people pay on quarterly,
yeah,
or on semester, or on annual?
Yeah.
So we've been really looking at that very with a sharp lens to see how benchmark with the world.
Yeah.
And that has helped us also to make sure that our reforms are aligned with international best practices.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
The other aspect is that is also helping us, our reform agenda is the Rwanda being a member of WTO and WCO,
yeah,
the World Customs Organization, the World Trade Organization. From customs and trade facilitation perspective, we implement whatever is happening in that space. So today we have a paperless customs department.
Mm-hmm.
You make a declaration, you make a payment without you moving to go and meet the tax officers.
Right.
So you're reducing time, you're reducing cost, but also you're eliminating human interaction.
Yeah.
That in the recent past was calling for corruption.
Yeah.
Some people who have those funny behavior.
Yeah.
You are limiting, as you reduce human interaction, even the corruption aspect disappears.
Yeah.
So that's I think what has been happening in our reform. We are still not yet what we want to be, but
yeah,
we think with the support of the government, the support of the government partners, we clearly understand where we're heading.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the one thing that and we don't have to go into details about it, but and I'll speak to some of your IT staff about, you know, the centrality of the digital system. So you mentioned, you know, limiting human interaction, etc. I am curious though about, or we see in other places, when you switch to all this paperless and you eliminate the need for people, mm-hmm, there's a question about what do you do with your staff? right? So the people who used to sit and process paperwork and face customers, how did you deal with, I don't know if it's exactly a challenge, but it's certainly something that goes with the territory of moving to this digital system. So was there a strategy for actually dealing with that?
Yes, we do have a strategy to deal with that. And I'll give you an example. Like when we automated our finance department, mm-hmm. we had about 80 people in that department. Because what happens in the finance department, you have to report, mm-hmm. reconcile.
Yeah.
So you can imagine the work that is involved in reconciling those accounts.
Yeah.
So when we introduced the financial system, in year one, we managed to reallocate, not lay off.
Yes. Yeah.
Reallocate at least about 25% of the workforce into other departments.
Yeah.
So it just speaks to how you redeploy your resources.
Yeah.
We haven't reached a level of really saying we need to lay off, because yes. for example, as you reduce people in finance, we are scaling up our working hours, for example in customs.
Yes.
Where some of the borders now working 24 hours.
Yeah.
So you need a 3-shift. So instead of sending these people home,
yeah.
you're training them to be customs officers,
exactly.
to join, to be part of the additional 2 shifts that we're adding to a border.
Yeah.
So that's how we've been trying to manage. But also, you need to understand that as you automate, you need also to the resource capabilities in the automation world. For example, now we are getting into data scientists.
Mm, mm.
So you're getting more statisticians
yeah.
and data scientists who are going to analyze that data. So you're getting too much information,
yeah.
much as you don't need the accountant who was doing back reconciliation, but you need someone this time with capabilities. So those are the dynamics. You keep on
exactly.
re-engineering your resource base to suit your business needs. So that's how we are. And for us, again, you realize that the biggest beneficiary is the taxpayer.
Yeah.
Because this time they can comply, we can get them, we have their contacts, you can SMS them when it is due date, remind them of their obligations, they can communicate directly to us
yeah.
without them leaving the office. So tax administration is a very key, is a center pillar in terms of creating a business environment. And yeah. I think we are trying to say, how can we be more efficient? How can we create more predictability, certainty in whatever we do for the taxpayer to understand and fulfill their obligations?
Yeah.
So taxpayer education again comes in very strongly, because you need to continuously engage them. You don't assume that you've automated, so what?
Yeah.
They need to understand how to do it.
Yeah.
So we are trying to really be close to them and educate them on how they need to be complying on most of these
yeah.
obligations.
Yeah. And something else that I think you might be able to speak to is, so I guess you were the head of customs when Rwanda joined the EAC, 2009.
No, I missed a few years.
You missed a few, okay.
Yeah, but I played a big role post.
Okay, so my question there is, so in our case study, we have a set format. So we talk about challenges, framing solutions, getting down to work. And then I think one of the most interesting parts of the case study is something called overcoming obstacles, which isn't necessarily in the negative sense. It can often be while you're reforming, you do good things and then something new comes along and you must adjust. And it can be very interesting. So I'm thinking joining the EAC is an interesting potential obstacle. And I want to get your take on that, because my sense would be, from a customs point of view, you're going to lose income. You're going to reduce barriers, you're going to reduce fees. And if I'm a tax collector, it makes me nervous when I lose income.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm curious about how you actually adjusted to joining the EAC, improving customs processes. And I do notice also that a big push for e-tax comes from the same period, 2009-2010. So I wonder if the two are connected in some way. Because my question would be, what ways did you find to compensate for the potential lost revenue, even though it's a good thing to join the EAC?
I think what joining EAC gave us a very big opportunity. One, it increased our market in terms of our exports base, which is still very small. But also being a net importer, it in a way eased the cost to our final consumers. And I'll try to give an example.
Okay.
The goods that we are importing originally from EAC, they are paying good taxes here at entry.
Yeah.
So what we are doing by that, you are increasing the cost to the final person down there. So the moment you remove that cost, which cost was also part of the expenses of the taxpayer.
Yeah.
So theoretically, the moment you don't tax him at entry, he's going to make a reasonable profit in domestic taxes when he sells the product at a lower cost. So your consumption levels go up because the consumer can afford, the consumer basket is a little bit widened by theoretically by doing that. So he can consume more. As he consumes more, the businessman is making a profit and you're going to tax that profit.
Right.
So you're only shifting
the
tax point.
Yes.
Instead of entry to exit when you're consuming. But also it helped us in the sense that when we joined EAC, we had an opportunity to dialogue and engage. I'll give an example. We formed what we call Commissioner General's Revenue Authorities Forum for the five countries. And what forum that forum does, we meet every semester and we discuss on challenges as tax administrators within the region. And we consolidate for we have like joint operations. We can make a joint operation between Rwanda and Uganda at the same time, consolidated mutual operation. So you're fighting, if it is corruption along the borders, you do it jointly.
Yeah.
If it is Tanzania, you do it jointly. So that brings in compliance across the borders for both of us, which you could not do when you're still in your own territory.
Yes.
As not part of the group. So that's the revenue that we lost in the short run has been mitigated by those externalities of growing trade and easing consumption burdens to our consumer to consume more, but also grow the trade. Because what is important, at the end of the day, we need to also to appreciate the fact that tax just comes at the end of the equation. Trade has to happen. So as you ease and design these trade policies within the region, we are starting to see a good progress in terms of our export base. And that's what we need. So in my view, we've not lost money.
Okay.
If anything, we've gained money. And the taxpayers, everybody is a winner in this. The consumers, our citizens are a winner.
Yeah.
The business community is winning. And we, as tax administrators, we are leveraging on that to grow our revenue base.
Very, very interesting way to look at it. And I think trade issues are very relevant these days in the whole world. So I think addressing this in the story, I think will give it some impact as well. I do want to ask you also about sort of looking forward. I've heard that recently there's been a shift, I think 2015, sort of maybe taking the next step when it comes to data analysis. You've mentioned, you know, the need for data scientists, etc. So just to compare it with Indonesia, which we did previously, where we did a case study recently, I think it's fair to say that they are far behind the RRA on many aspects, but they seem to have started slightly earlier with the idea that big data is going to solve their, let's say, much bigger problems than yours. What is your take on sort of the RRA taking a next step in terms of, you know, monitoring compliance, finding people who are still not paying through, you know, data analytics? Is that something that's on the agenda?
Yes, it is on the agenda. And again, learning from our past experience, I was how the reforms that we've been making, I think the reason why we think we are going to succeed in that journey, mm-hmm. one is to, what we are doing is not within RRI alone. We are trying to fit it to the national strategy. So the government of Rwanda adopted back there in 2017, April, the cabinet approved what we call the data revolution strategy.
Uh-huh.
So that data revolution strategy is what we're trying to fit in.
I see.
But again, it's a new area altogether,
yeah.
globally. So you need to be very careful how you move in that direction. So we've said, how do we move into that direction? Being a new area with very few expertise.
Mm.
So we are leveraging now on our partners. DFID has been supporting us. But as DFID supports us, being a UK originating, they also, we also managed to get the support of Her Majesty's Revenue Authority, UK.
Mm-hmm.
So we are working with HRMC, Her Majesty's Revenue Authority, to help us in the data journey.
Mm-hmm.
So we've had a preliminary visit, a fact finding visit with one of the experts. We are trying to draw a 5-year plan,
mm-hmm.
so that we don't try to make it a quick fix.
Mm-hmm.
And we are trying to have the building blocks. But also, we are in such an opportune time,
yeah.
where our president has managed to build centers of excellence,
mm.
of which have some of them have come to Rwanda. So we have the Carnegie Mellon University in Rwanda, and we have now AIMS, the Institute of Mathematical Science.
Right, yeah.
So they are producing very brilliant products in terms of graduates that are coming on the market. So we partnered with those two universities,
mm-hmm.
and we are going to be taking some of those brilliant students to come, because some of them are data scientists, others are mathematicians, and they are coming to work with us.
Right.
So as we build the long-term plan, you're getting these brains to support the plan, and that gives us confidence that we're going to succeed in that direction. Of course, we under the government national strategy that is actually trying to move in that.
Yeah.
And I think the other key success factor that we are seeing is what the government has invested in terms of ICT being a key enabler.
Mm.
Unlike some countries, I don't know the case for Indonesia, but Rwanda, the penetration in terms of ICT is really deep. You're talking of close to 80% of mobile penetration, and everything is being done on this, on the phone.
Yeah.
So if you have 80% penetration and you're hitting, say, about 40% on internet penetration, you are getting data rich.
Yeah.
Because you can dream of data science. If you don't have data, you're not going to do much.
That's right. Yeah. yeah.
So we are trying now to consolidate all our data into one space. And that's why the government also, almost a year ago, we set up what we call RISA, mm-hmm. Rwanda Information. It's a body that's now in charge of our ICT as a country.
Okay. RISA.
RISA.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'll look it up. Yeah.
So that's how that's giving us confidence. And
right.
Again, when you look at our president, his vision again is to say, okay, how do you build a very inclusive society,
yeah.
so that you can design your policies around all the citizens, and data is a very key story on that. So the National Institute of Statistics is driving that strategy to ensure that we have the statistics that can speak to our operations and policy. And I know now there's another project that is actually being piloted under RISA of what they call citizenry registry. Like what happens, I think, in the US, where you get your, what they call, social security number.
Yeah.
We're getting into that.
Mm-hmm.
From the when the kid is born, to you, to have that, and that's how ICT is trying to really drive the transformation of the country. And we are saying, as taxman, you don't want to lag behind and start playing a catch-up game.
Yeah,
we are trying to be proactive and be a little bit ahead. As we get data rich, how do we leverage on that to ease and improve compliance of our taxpayers?
Would it be fair to say that if it's up to you, big data analytics is the next big thing for the RRA? It's the next, you know, sort of era.
That would be the right sentiment.
And it's what's interesting to me as well, the way you frame it as part of a national sort of vision, because I think it's something, and I'm gonna throw the idea out, and maybe you can say if I'm right or wrong. In other places where revenue authorities struggle, they often do so, my impression is, because it's a bit of a scattered approach. They're trying to do something, but the government is pulling in all kinds of different directions. Here, to me, it seems like the creation of the RRA was something that was seen as part of the almost fundamental goal of the government, to say that we want to become independent of foreign money so that we can finance our own budget eventually. And the RRA was almost an expression of this sort of broad national goal. And now again, when you talk about this, you know, the data side fitting in with a bigger national vision, is it fair to say that that's something that either sets Rwanda apart or has really played a really significant role in giving you the kind of autonomy, the powers, the flexibility, all the things, the tools you needed? Because I suspect there are colleagues in other countries who would give their arm to get the kind of support that the RRA has had. Can you talk about that a bit?
Yes, I think we have the power. And for your information, some of these reforms that we make, some of them are internally generated, others are externally generated. Right. So you find that there is a coherence in terms of what we do.
That's the word.
Like, for example, as I talk about data-centered tax administration, at the same time, the government, through the Central Bank and the Ministry of Finance, they are pushing for a cashless economy, almost cashless economy. So we have a target, I think, by 2024, according to the monetary policy report that came out last month, we need to get to at least over 80% of our transactions should be digital. So most of these reforms that we are talking about, they're not entirely within our scope to implement, but they're national in nature.
Yeah, they don't stand in isolation from
not at all
the bigger picture. Yeah,
like as we speak now, I know there's a meeting that is going on with the ministers of finance, minister of trade, and other ministers on doing business. World Bank doing business reforms, and one of the reforms that we are discussing, there are some tax reforms that are there. So we are. That's how the level of ownership of reforms is in terms of broad sense. So yes, you are coming up with these initiatives, but there's strong ownership, and the head of state gets a report on what we are doing on doing business, and as a report on doing business, the paying taxes indicators come up, and you question, why are you lagging behind on this? What support do you need? So it becomes a national owned agenda, as opposed to this is Commissioner General's business, and the level of accountability is extremely high. So that's the kind of support that we get to ensure that we can reform very quickly.
In a way, to me, people always talk about political will, but it's almost like it goes beyond that in Rwanda. It's like it's so coordinated in a way that I think it's something that we should highlight. Okay, so it's all very positive and glowing, but I do want to be fair and ask, what are the remaining difficulties? I mean, I hear about, you know, especially smaller taxpayers, the culture of paying is perhaps something that's still not quite where it needs to be. This sheer number of taxpayers in Rwanda, I think, is still relatively low. Can you talk a bit about some of the, you know, it shouldn't be unrealistic. Of course, there are still challenges.
No, the challenges are there. I think one of the changes that you need to understand is Rwanda has made the choice of inclusive growth. The growth that you see in Kigali is the same growth that you see any part of the country. So if you're going to have that kind of inclusiveness, you need everybody to pay a fair share. Mm. So the small taxpayers, we still have the informal sector. Mm. And one of the biggest challenges I think that we have is the cash transactions. Mm. They still carry a bigger chunk of our transactions, and with cash, visibility disappears. Mm. So that's one of the biggest challenges. Mm. Cash encourages non-compliance.
Yes.
And that's why we're engaging at national level to say, how do we become cash-light economy? Yeah. So that we are discussing to say, is the transactions in the digital space. But we are also discussing a possibility of starting to introduce some laws, for example, putting a cap on the amount that you can transact by cash.
Mm. Mm.
The other challenge that I think we have is to do with the staff, the skill base. Much as I talked about us scaling up the skill base, mm. you need to appreciate that the economy has been growing by over 70% sustainably, and calls for more human capital.
Yes. And within the RRA.
Within Rwanda.
And within Rwanda.
So we are competing on a very few skill base.
Mm.
So the private sector is poaching people here.
Right.
And by the time you know it, you are in, all the time you're in the training phase.
Yeah.
So that's a big challenge. Losing staff, the competent staff are moving out.
Yeah.
We're not saying we're going to really chase the private sector in terms of remuneration, mm. but we are trying to devise means to see how can we retain people.
Yeah.
So the pay has not been really moving up at the same pace, but we are discussing with the government to see how we can address those challenges.
Okay.
But also we are trying to see how can we get more strategic in terms of retaining our staff. Reward is one thing, but the other thing that you could do to keep people motivated in terms of staff development and engagement.
Yeah.
So that's another challenge. The other challenge that we have, I think, is to do with we are an open economy.
Mm.
We are attracting investors from over the world. We've made a choice not to have restrictions in terms of cash repatriation.
Okay.
So we're getting multinationals coming to invest in Rwanda.
Mm.
So are we ready for them to tax them efficiently?
Yeah.
In terms of base erosion and profit shifting.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Transfer pricing.
Transfer pricing.
Yeah.
So that's a big challenge that we have. We've just set up a unit in charge of that.
Yeah.
And in the next couple of years, we hope that we are going to intensify our capabilities in that space. So those are the challenges that we are mainly facing, but we are optimistic, and the optimism again is coming from the government.
Yeah.
We've also tried to leverage on our people. That's why I think someone is in my office.
Mm.
We're trying to say, how do we get people who have been playing that league to come and be part of us?
Yeah.
And we're getting experts through the development partners to support us, get the unique resources, people that we need to come and work with us, of course, not on a permanent basis. 1-2 year contract, make an impact, train people, move on. And so we are trying also to make an institutional review.
Mm-hmm.
To review our people, the skills that we need, to review our technology capabilities, what we have, how is it speaking to our service delivery?
Yeah.
Do we need to consolidate more? We're also trying to look at the data business that we talked about,
mm-hmm.
but also how we can structure a business that has capabilities to handle the challenges going forward. So we're trying to. We have a reform that is starting possibly by June.
Okay.
That is, we are going to have a blueprint
mm-hmm.
of our institution in the next 10 years, how it has to look like. And the staff have already given their contributions, so we are going to really have a solid picture of what we want to be in 10 years.
Right.
And then we start having the building blocks towards that journey.
Yeah.
So that's going to form our reform agenda going forward.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So I think we're almost at 11. I think we have 5 minutes. In those 5 minutes, maybe my last question to you is maybe always the most interesting one. If you could speak to the head of a revenue authority in a country where it's not going well, what would be your two or three pieces of advice? Sort of maybe even on a personal level, but also institutionally, what is it that you need to lead an institution like this to sort of become more effective in a place where it's not necessarily already?
One, I think, is to ensure that you get the autonomy.
Right.
The autonomy is very key for you to really be flexible in terms of how you resource and fulfill your mandate. Number two, I would advise him to encourage the government, the policymakers, if they don't have it, to look at ICT as a strong enabler. Yeah. I'll give an example, like for Rwanda, under our leadership, the president decided to say, don't tax computers, don't tax phones, don't tax telecom equipment at entry level when you're importing.
Wow.
And what that has done, basically the vision I think that he had, which is now we are leveraging on,
yeah,
is to say, look at this ICT as an enabler, not as a cash cow.
Yeah.
You'll make more money in the long run, but let it flourish. So some countries, they have some commissioners who have come here to benchmark and all that.
Yeah.
And if you don't address that, because today, at least I can say, anybody can declare and pay on mobile phone. But if you've denied the penetration, if your penetration levels are in 30% of your population, then you cannot dream of mobile payment, mobile declaration.
Yeah. Yeah.
So for me, that's very, very important.
Wow.
I think the other key thing is to do with the behavior, the discipline. You need to have a very strong zero tolerance policy on corruption matters. So you need to, much as you, I'm not saying you should not empower your staff, empower them, but make sure there are clear lines of how you're monitoring the behavior, because corruption can really be bad. Especially tax administration, it can really take a lot of money. So you need to have a very strong zero tolerance policy. And I think the last one that I see is to do with the level of accountability. Who do you report to? How often do you get audited? That's very, very important. So we have like the Office of Auditor General auditing us every single year on revenue reporting, on IT, on procurement. So You are always held accountable on some of these things, the best practices. How are you performing? Why are you lagging behind on this?
Right.
Yeah, and I think that's, to me, that's very important. But also, last but not least, is the way, being honest with your development partners. The development partners always want to support revenue authorities because of the central role that plays.
Yeah.
And if you're not honest with them in terms of your problems, and actually proving that there is value for money in terms of the technical assistance that they give you. Because if you manage the development partners in a transparent and honest manner, sharing your journey in terms of reforms, your challenges, you will stand a very high chance of success.
On the audit point, I understand that the internal audit function here is also quite interesting in that it reports to the board, not to you.
Absolutely.
Which can happen in other places and create all other kinds of issues. So do you sometimes have have to fire people? Does it still happen occasionally because of corruption or allegations or things?
Yes, we do. We do fire people.
Okay.
It's part of the job. You can't really be a tax administration and not get those problems. It's getting less as you go along, as you automate and all that. But still, people will try to test and make funny deals here and there.
Right, well, I think that brings us exactly to 11, so we can stop it right there. Thank you very much, sir.